All right, guys, we're here at MVP Days, and today I'm joined by an esteemed crew, and we're going to be chatting with you guys about NanoServer, which is one of the new options that's coming in that's coming in Server 2016, which is in technical preview 4 right now. That's what all the demos are going to be based off of that I have for you. And then also, here's our contact information. I'm Clint Wyckoff.
Sean the Energized Tech.
And I'm Dave Kula.
Awesome, guys. Thanks for joining us. And like I said, this session's being recorded for those folks that weren't able to see it, so we're going to put this up on Channel 9 for those folks to see afterwards. As always, please be social. Again, we're going to be raffling off a free pass to Tech Mentor that's in December, Orlando, completely free, so you guys go there and get some free training.
Perfect business case for why do I need to go to Florida in December.
Exactly. So tweet out to the hashtag CDN MVP Days for a chance to win. All right. So a little bit about ourselves. I know the next slide is going to be a little bit busy, but
a little bit.
So that's why I had to throw the disclaimer up here. This is what not to do with.
We're going to learn a little bit about virtualization, but get a little bit of office application training here at the same
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. What not to do with the PowerPoint presentation is that right there.
This is a bad example of a PowerPoint slide.
Again, my name is Clint Wyckoff. By day, I'm a global technical evangelist for Veeam Software, as well as a Microsoft MVP. The expert, active in the community. Sean?
I'm a senior solutions architect, Systel Technology in Ottawa. I'm also, if you've ever gone to scriptingguys.com at Microsoft, I'm one of the honorary scripting guys. You may have seen a lot of my work over the past year, about 15% of the content's for me. And I'm, well, it used to be a Windows PowerShell MVP, and now I'm a cloud and data center management MVP. I'm a nerd, I'm a geek.
Awesome. Dave?
I am Dave Kula. I am a Hyper-V MVP because I've refused to conform to the new MVP standard that you guys have.
Shall bow down.
Exactly. So we're all System Center Cloud Data Center MVPs, and we got an awful lot of brain power here to talk about something really small.
Yeah, absolutely. So who in the room has actually heard about this new thing called NanoServer? Show of hands. Quite a few of you guys
Holy
have.
Holy cow.
That's the whole room. I think in the way back in the upper deck, too, we've got a whole set of hands there, too.
Yeah, for the viewers out there, we're in one of the largest auditoriums here at the Delta Montreal presenting to the MVP Days crowd. So thank you for joining us, everybody. But if we can remember back, long in a galaxy far, far away, long, long time ago.
Copyright infringement,
complete disclosure there. But it really all started about 10 or 11 years ago, at least for Microsoft, down their voyage or their venture of what they're calling Hyper-V today, right? So it actually all started with Virtual PC back in 2005 with an acquisition that Microsoft bought whenever they bought Virtual PC. And during the keynote, I was talking about Ben Armstrong this morning. And if you try to go to contact Ben, he's at Virtual PC Guy on Twitter or virtualpcguy@microsoft.com. Ben actually was one of the lead program managers at Virtual PC that came over with the acquisition.
I think his company was actually called Kinex or something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, and their product was Virtual PC.
That's correct, yes.
And then here's just a little bit, right? So things have evolved over the course of many, many, many years, right? Just like anything else in the data center. So NanoServer is a new option that's coming in Server 2016. But really, what is the problem in today's modern data center, right? The first thing that Microsoft has recognized from their customers and partners is that unnecessary system downtime, there's a cost associated with that, right? Whether it be reboots or, like I mentioned, like hard down situations, or if I need to patch my hosts, having to evacuate all those guest virtual machines off of there, having to take the host down, that puts extra pressure on the environment, right? That downtime that's associated with that, AKA reboots, like that really upsets folks, right? Patch Tuesday comes along and I have to reboot not only all of my guest virtual machines, but I have to reboot and patch all of my Hyper-V hosts as well, because there could be perhaps security vulnerabilities, there could be perhaps hot fixes that are fixing issues at the host level. So one of the first things that NanoServer is set out to fix is this reboot problem. And Microsoft actually did a study, and we'll talk about this a little bit in the next slide, but Microsoft has actually done a study over the course of the last year. So if you take NanoServer as compared to Server Core and Server GUI, the amount of reboots is, and the amount of hotfixes required in causing those reboots is down to like single digits, right? So if, say, for instance, Server GUI required you know, 15, 20 reboots because of patches. NanoServer only required, you know, 2, 3, 4 reboots because of hot fixes.
That's, and the other thing about reboots that most people forget is it's always a risk factor for the reboot. It should just restart the next time, but there's been just as many servers over all the years I've worked on that you go to reboot, and what's the first screen you get to see? Not your login screen, the blue screen of death.
Right.
So it's always a risk assessment.
And specific to virtualization, guys, this is a really interesting point, is that Microsoft, with their platform team, the Hyper-V base binaries that come and form that hypervisor that Microsoft provides, that's the same set of core binaries that are going to be on Windows 10, on the Windows Server 2016 with a GUI, on Nano Server, on Core. It's the same Hyper-V across all of them. So if you have the ability to have a platform that dramatically reduces all of that management, maintenance, reboots, all of those pieces, why would you not take a look at that? So direct from the product team, they're strongly encouraging people to look at this as, you know, a great way to take and have ease of management inside of your environment.
Absolutely. And the second bullet item here that NanoServer is set out to resolve is the fact that server images themselves are too large, whether that be the actual ISO file or maybe perhaps it's the backup file that comes out whenever I'm trying to back up guest virtual machines, or even maybe you're backing up the actual Hyper-V host itself, right? But being able to easily move and migrate workloads around the environment. Take, for example, the maintenance window that I had just mentioned earlier. If I need to migrate, say, 15, 20, 50 virtual machines off of a host, each one of those have virtual RAM associated with them, right? It takes time to migrate those workloads over the network, over my live migration infrastructure, or maybe I'm even using storage migration, but it takes time to migrate those, right? So they're seeing that the fact that server images are too large causing problems, disk space, right? Each one of those VMs and hosts has to have a required disk space to consume, that being the other part of it too.
Yeah. The other thing to consider in your server images right now is it's just like the Windows 10 image, is that inside your server image is a complete set of operating system files in the Windows side by side that may be features you're never ever going to use. That's sitting in every single one of those.
Right. So one of the other things that NanoServer set out to fix is the amount of resources required to actually run the host itself. Because the Hyper-V host, you know, if I have other roles and features installed on there, maybe perhaps I've accidentally enabled IIS, or, you know, if I'm running the full server core, this full server GUI version of it, or even the core version, right? A lot of the .NET binaries are there, the complete side-by-side directory. So if I want to enable any rules and features, there's a lot of extra weight and bloat, okay? Now that's going to create a much larger security footprint, a much larger attack surface for folks to get into, more vulnerabilities. So by reducing the size, the resource consumption, I'm now able to, A, fit more VMs on there. I can get much higher density counts, right? Having a smaller physical footprint in the data center, but now also I've reduced the attack footprint, the surface attack area that folks can get in to the data center. And one of the things that Microsoft's stressing with Hyper-V 2016 and even Windows Server 2016 is completely changing the way that folks look at security in the data center, right? We oftentimes come from a, let's try to keep folks out, right? Let's put up a wall, a barrier to keep folks out of the environment. Well, we all realize that we're in an era of ransomware and hackers where we have to kind of shift the mentality from trying to keep people out, but assume they're already in, right? So if somebody gets into the data center, how am I going to mitigate the attack footprint? How can I guard people from spreading around from host to host? So one of the things that they're bringing in servers, Hyper-V 2016, is this concept of shielded virtual machines and the host guardian service, preventing people from actually stealing your virtual machines and running them on alternate hardware someplace else. Because if you're protecting it with the host guardian, now I'm only allowing those VMs to be run on specific pieces of hardware, right? And there's even what they call attestation reports. So you can actually get back and report on and show back which virtual machines are allowed to run in specific locations. So as the VMs boot up, they're checking to see, is this host okay for me to run on? If yes, it boots up. If no, you get basically access denied.
Nice.
So much like everything else, and we've talked about this a little bit, is the evolution, right? So Windows Server has gone through the course of a lot of changes over the course of the years, right? If we think back to, you know, NT Server 2003, there was a couple of different variations, right? Even Server 2008, if I wanted to run SQL Server, right, and I wanted to run failover clustering, I had to make sure that I installed the data center version of Windows Server. But maybe I didn't need all those features and functionality. So one of the things that Server 2012, 2012 R2 have done, right, regardless of which version of Windows Server you deploy, you get all the roles and features that can be enabled on there.
And in 2012 R2, we took and we started to see Server Core coming mainstream.
Yep.
So a lightweight, you know, headless version that had the GUI stripped out, right? And in 2012 R2, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, with a few couple switches, we could actually turn the GUI on and off.
Yeah, I actually thought that was quite nice because I still remember my coworkers in McKesson looking, saying, oh, you know, we'd like to do core, but the problem is, what if we need, let's just say we got a consultant comes in, we gotta turn the GUI back on, can we? Nope. But with 2012 R2, that was an option, which meant if you needed to turn the GUI on, it was there, but you didn't have to have all that overhead and all that space eaten up by the GUI live and just leave it off.
Right. So one of the things that they've been kind enough to go ahead and do is do comparison. So if you go out and deploy Windows Server full GUI version, right, that takes up around 10 gigabytes worth of space. You have to add on all the extra space that's required for patches and things like that. So if you're deploying, say, you know, a 40, 60, 80, 100 gig OS partition for the servers, right, that takes up a lot of space in the data center. So Server Core gets it down to around 4 gig. But with the introduction of Nano, now we're talking 400 megabytes, right? Not
very
gigabytes,
small.
Megabytes. Super small. In fact, the only thing that you can do on Nano Server, literally the only thing that you can do on Nano through the actual console is change firewall, give it an IP address. That is absolutely 100% all that you can do.
Not even a command prompt?
Not even a command prompt.
That's,
no, everything.
I like that, actually.
Well, you don't need a command prompt anymore, Sean. You know
why?
I
never use command prompt.
Well, you can do PowerShell direct into it.
True.
Right?
So
you don't even
PowerShell remoting still? I can still use my RSAT tools on that.
RSAT tools? Absolutely.
So why do I need to have a GUI in my server then?
You don't.
That's what I thought.
And so if you guys get paid by the hour to build servers, you're going to probably have to increase your hourly rate because Nano probably installs in a couple minutes. Because it's got such a light footprint that it's actually up and running. We're going to actually show a really cool demo of the installation of Nano a little bit later on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, it's not if you actually mount the ISO and you boot to the ISO of Windows Server 2016, right? It's not an installable feature of it, okay? You have to actually mount the ISO and then go through a couple of steps that you can create either a VHDX, so you can create a VHDX so you can have virtual Nano Server, or you can use that to go out and create a physical Nano Server as well, just like you would any other Hyper-V virtual machine, or excuse me, Hyper-V physical host. Or you can use traditional WIM files, and say, for instance, WinPE to boot up that, to apply the WIM file to your guest part, to your OS partition on a piece of physical bare metal hardware.
Yeah. There's actually an article on Ken IT Pro right now where you can use Nano Server to actually use Windows Deployment Services. You put the Nano Server media down there and you can just walk to your PC, do Pixie boot, and have Nano Server deployed instantly to physical hardware. For those that can't do you right now, you can't do domain join through an online domain. You're still into using what's called offline domain joining.
Right.
I don't know if that's a permanent capability. That's just at present day at Nano, because right now Nano is still being written. Like what we're seeing right now, what we're hearing about right now, is Nano Server in the trial media right now. It's still being improved and rewritten by Microsoft right now.
Right. So whenever you actually go out to create your Nano virtual hard disk or physical piece of media that you're going to boot to and install, by default, there's no roles, there's no features, there's nothing in it. It's literally just it's nothing. You have to tell it what you want to put on it whenever you're creating these physical pieces of media or the virtual hard disks. And I'll show you that through the demo that I have. So for example, whenever you go actually start to create via PowerShell this Nano virtual machine or physical machine that you're going to use, you just simply use the dash compute rule if I want to enable or inject in the Hyper-V binaries. If I want to enable it, and maybe I'm using it on a piece of JBOD storage for storage spaces direct or scale out file server, the dash storage, or add it to a cluster. Down here, the drivers part is interesting. The second one from the bottom there is that the guest drivers, whenever you inject the guest drivers, that enables that, and it'll install the necessary drivers for it to be run as a virtual machine. If you want to deploy Nano on a physical piece of hardware, Microsoft has created a bundle, what they call OEM drivers, for all of their original equipment manufacturers that are shipping product today. So that'll include the physical drivers required to run Nano on a bare metal piece of hardware.
So Clint, I have a quick question before you just advance the slide. Would you say that in doing this, Microsoft is really trying to treat the hypervisor with Nano Server as a commodity?
Yeah.
So we can just easily spin these up and down, and it shouldn't be a large, arduous process to actually, you know, introduce, you know, more either hypervisors where we can run compute, or seamlessly transition these workloads up to Azure environments when it becomes
available. Right. So that's the main use cases for NanoServer are to be used as a Hyper-V host or a container host. So anyone in here familiar with the concept of containers? Right, there's Docker containers. One of the things that's coming in Hyper-V 2016 is Windows-based containers. So now I have this concept of being able to write code once, deploy many times anywhere, this kind of this cloud platform strategy that Microsoft has. So if I deploy code on-prem, I should be able to use that same code, that same set of virtual machines and containers that I can deploy out in Azure as well, right? So it's a fantastic way, as Dave mentioned, right, to rapidly scale up and scale down based on business demands and requirements. Maybe I've got an application, it's my mission critical app, right? It's my sales, point of sales. During, say, for instance, the busy holiday season, I want to add 3, 4, 5 more web front end servers to handle all the load that's going to be coming in, right? I can easily scale that up. After the holiday season, I'm going to tear it back down again and go back to normal operating efficiencies, right? So what does headless really mean? So if you go out there and you look up, say, for instance, Jeffrey Snover's discussion that he gave at Microsoft Ignite last year, they really talk about this concept of headless, right? Windows Nano Server is this headless operating system. They say it over and over and over again. It's really the concept of having to manage remotely. So if you've already been familiar with Server Core, this kind of takes it a little bit further because you can't really do anything at the console level. Everything you do has to be done remotely. Okay, now that shouldn't scare anybody because you're already familiar with using Server Manager. You're already familiar with using PowerShell perhaps. If you're not, that's definitely something that you want to at least go out there and what my favorite thing to do is, you know, take somebody else's code and make it your own and adapt, because I'm not a developer like Sean is.
I'm not a developer either.
These guys.
Efficient professionals.
Yes.
Micro and TP in technical preview right now, if you go out into the Azure marketplace, there's a server management tool that you can deploy within Azure that is a web UI that will allow you to actually have a web UI in Azure managing on-prem Nano Server. So it gives you kind of a GUI-based version of managing these through the cloud, so that now as folks have not only just private cloud, right, running in on-prem in your environment, but as you build out more of a hybrid type scenario, that you can have that single consistent platform, that single consistent interface for managing all of your Nano Servers, as well as third-party tools like there's a company, Five9 Software. Anyone ever heard of Five9 before? They have they're currently developing their Five9 Manager, which is a Hyper-V tool, right, to manage Hyper-V hosts that'll manage Nano Servers as well. And with that, I'm actually going to kill the PowerPoint and give you guys a little bit of a demo and a sneak peek into what this really looks like. So in my environment, everything that I'm going to do today is completely 100% being done off of my Windows 10 laptop. Okay, I've got an SSD drive in here. I've got the Hyper-V role enabled. Everything is going to be done locally on my machine. The first thing that I've done is I've gone out to the Microsoft website and I've already downloaded Windows Server 2016 Technical Preview 4. And with that, I've mounted it to my machine here. So if we notice here, there's a Nano Server directory. Okay, this is here by default. Whenever I go in here, you'll see there's a couple of files that you should be interested in. The first one is this Convert Windows image, as well as the Nano Server image generator. All right, what you do is control click and you copy these guys, and you want to copy them over to your local hard disk. AKA, this is going to be your source directory where all of your PowerShell is going to reference. Okay, so in here, as you can see, I've been doing a lot of these over the course of the last few days. So there's a little bit of a couple of things going on in here. But as you can see here, I've copied over these two PowerShell scripts. All right, that's the first thing that you need to do. The second thing you need to do is open up PowerShell ISE. All right, so I've already made my cNano directory. I've copied over my two PowerShell scripts that I need. Right, we're going to change directory and now import those modules into this PowerShell session. Okay, so whenever I go out to type commands, IntelliSense is going to know, and the actual PowerShell modules are going to be loaded into this session that I've got here. So if we run that, right, it's imported the modules, everything's good to go. So now if I come in here and I actually start new nano server image, right, base path, okay, base path is the directory, my cNano server, base path c colon backslash nano, right? But one of the other first things that you'll need to do, and you only need to do this the first time, is this media path, okay? Media path is where my ISO is mounted to. So here, it's E. So if I switch back, I go E colon backslash. Now, I only need to do this, as I said, the first time. Because what this is going to do is, the first time I run my new nano server script here, it's going to copy off of the ISO, the media, the necessary files and binaries to my source directory being cNano, right? So if I switch back, you're going to notice there's a packages folder that's got a bunch of different packages, say IIS, failover clustering. We talked about compute containers. Right? It's going to copy those over so whenever I reference that directory during my PowerShell script, everything's local there, ready to go. Switching back over to PowerShell ISE. My target path is where I want my output to go. Now you can see here I've got it called mvpdays007.vhdx, and I'm injecting in, let me zoom in for you guys so you can see this a little better. I'm injecting in the compute role, the clustering role, guest drivers, because this is going to be deployed as a virtual machine, but also the reverse forwarders. So who in here has any idea what reverse forward is? Anybody? You probably in the back, you might perhaps know. No? How about you gentlemen in the back? No, you don't know either?
Helping the other balcony? No.
Well, the reverse forward is, as I mentioned, there's no .NET framework on here, okay? Microsoft has completely redone the actual kernel itself and a lot of the DLLs. So reverse forward is going to allow your legacy applications, maybe you have Ruby applications or you have .NET applications that are referencing old DLL files, the reverse forwarders, all that's going to do is going to forward from the old DLL to the new DLL. It's just a forwarder, okay? I'm also enabling the containers role, storage. Now this one here is an interesting one for you folks, right? This domain blob path. My laptop itself, this laptop, is not on the same domain as the machine I'm going to deploy. I have a domain that's called demo.local. My laptop is not on that domain. So what I've done here is I've harvested out of my domain a blob using djoin, and I save that to a text file, right? So I've pre-populated with mvpdays007. So I'm going to reference that text. But if your machine that you're running this on, maybe it's a server in the same domain, if you just do the dash domain name, you can just say demo.local, and it knows, since this machine is on that domain, it's going to automatically add it to it. Okay? Pretty easy. We'll comment all this out. Now you can see here, I'm injecting in the local admin password, which is super secure to do.
What are you putting my banking password on there for?
Come my on. Apologies.
Because Chris is not watching.
So we're going to go ahead and give this a run. So now we can watch here the status of it. It's attaching the VHDX, it's going to go through and it's going to initialize, and it's going to start to create a virtual hard disk and inject in all the roles and features that I told it to with using the switches, dash compute, dash clustering, dash containers, dash storage, right? And it's going to build this VHD, or maybe it's a WIM file that I want to deploy on a physical piece of hardware. It's going to do that live for me. So it's completely 100% custom, right? It only has what's required for that server, right? The server is going to be a part of a cluster. I include the cluster package. It's going to be a Hyper-V host. I include the compute package. It's going to be run containers, I include the containers. It only has what it needs to serve its purpose. Right? It doesn't have any extra bloat, doesn't have anything that's not needed.
No solitaire?
No solitaire.
What?
And Clay, in the spirit of community, I know a lot of people here are trying to learn more about NanoServer. Is the demo scripts that you're building here, they pretty much, they would run on anybody's environment as long as they've got a Windows 10 laptop or something that they can build this on.
Yeah.
Are you going to publish this on a OneDrive link or something so that they can try the stuff at home?
Yeah, we can make it available with the presentation.
Folks. Pro Block, for example.
I'm sorry?
On the Kent IT Pro Block, for example.
We can work with Pierre.
Yeah, we can. Clint's a Hyper-V MVP as well, so yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a good idea.
So you can see here, if I zoom in really quickly for you folks, right, we can see that it's adding packages. Like right now it's adding the Nano compute package, right? It's injecting these in live on the fly. And it's going to take a couple of minutes to kind of go through the process here. But while this is going through, does anybody have any questions or anything that what we talked about so far?
Yes, sir.
You are going to be able to run that off that Windows 10 machine, are you?
Oh, absolutely.
This is a Windows Server 64-bit?
This is Windows 10 laptop, absolutely. I've enabled the
Windows 10 laptop, are you going to run that 64-bit off the Windows 10 machine?
Yes. So I've actually already have running on my laptop.
Yeah.
These are all the VMs that I have a domain controller, I have a Hyper-V host, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 other Nano servers, as well as a full GUI running on here.
That's right. So lots of RAM.
This machine here has 16 gigabytes worth of memory, and I have a 256 gig SSD hard drive.
That's really one of the keys, guys. If you're going to try to build this stuff at home or in your home lab, the commercial SSD drives have really come down in price. So probably for a 256 gig SSD drive, it's a couple hundred bucks now. They're not that bad, and it's a great upgrade for your home lab machine, even more so than all of the RAM. Like, we used to just stack up a whole bunch of RAM when we would build this stuff, but now if you can get a 256 or a 512 gig SSD, and then if you have a separate volume, you can even enable like deduplication, because it's not in production. I know that it's not really supported by Microsoft in prod, but on your dev machines, you can get a massive amount of space savings by building your labs doing that.
But then Nano doesn't support deduplication.
No, deduplicating the actual VMs themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't support, we can't do it. So it's a small Nano server,
with
a big VM, or the big server with deduplication and small VMs.
First of all, he's only saying for a lab environment, right?
Yeah,
you would never
for
run.
Not for production, but for a lab environment.
It's not really going to save that much for Nano, but if you have other workloads running on there, so if you have other Windows Server instances and stuff like that to formulate and build your lab, you'll get a tremendous space savings on those for sure.
Right.
I've seen 60 to 80% on my lab machines. We do a lot of training, right? So we can actually push these things. On a 700 gig SSD drive, I've got 3.3 terabytes on my laptop right now at home. Because it's always the same bits over and over again, right? There's nothing really changing inside of there.
So inside of my source directory here, or my source directory, we can see my output being MVP days 007, with the size of it being around 757 megabytes worth of space. Notice how the other ones are different sizes, because I was testing out adding in different packages and things. So they're completely 100% customized right now. Maybe perhaps you come up with, okay, this is the way that I deploy Hyper-V in my environment, right? You would create this one time, and you can deploy it over and over and over and over again. Maybe Microsoft comes out with Server 2016 that includes Service Pack 2. Okay, well, let me go back and redo this so that I don't necessarily have to apply Service Pack 2 or Update 2, right? Or different roll-ups that might come out afterwards, right? I mean, I know that we talked about minimal security patches, but there are going to be hot fixes and things that are gonna maybe fix or add functionality. So the next step in the demo that I wanted to show you here is we're actually gonna deploy this as a virtual machine and power it up, right? So I'm just gonna copy this little snippet of PowerShell right here, and I'm gonna deploy, and in just a matter of, since the time that we've been here, I would have created a virtual hard disk. If I switch over to Hyper-V Manager, we'll see it pop in there, 007. It's going to power on. And I told it to open the console as well, right, the VM connect command. With this, we'll see, whenever this VM
does boot up here in a second or two, right? I can log in with administrator.
Good old Linux base.
And I can log in. We can see that it's already a part of my demo.local domain. If I tab down here, right, the only things you can do are networking, right? Here's the adapter MAC address. Right now I've got DHCP enabled on this. I didn't assign a static IP address, but that's one of the other switches, right? You can assign a static IP. I can give it the mask. I can give it the gateway, right? So these things can be fully deployed very, very rapidly. So if I switch over to my server here, with any luck, I should have ping MVP day 007, based on T, right? It's already replying. It's the .161. We saw that in the user interface there in the console, with which is, this is what Microsoft calls the emergency management console. That's the technical term for the nano server physical console, okay? So the next part of the demo is to switch over here. Minimize this, open failover cluster manager. We can see that I've got four hosts, four nodes as part of my cluster all the way up to 005. If I open up my PowerShell here, we're going to add git cluster, name nano cluster, add cluster node, MVP days 007, add, that goes. We're going to see a bar come across here. It's adding it to my failover cluster, MVP day 007. Is now a member of my cluster, ready to accept VMs, right? So if I was running hot, scaling up, maybe I need to add new web servers to the environment. The example that we talked about earlier, now I have more Hyper-V compute in my environment, and I can start to move workloads over to here in a relatively short amount of time.
So what if we wanted to do that? Is it possible, guys, to do that on bare metal as well? So can you deploy nano on bare metal?
Right.
It doesn't need to be a virtual machine. We're just using the example of a virtual machine here because it's something that we can easily demonstrate. Clint got frustrated with having to keep rebuilding his laptop over and over again. So
I do have a test laptop at home that I was using WinPE. So when I essentially have a USB, an external USB drive that I downloaded. WinPE formatted the USB, and on there you can deploy a WIM, right? Sean has other ways that he's going to talk with you guys in another session, so I don't want to steal his thunder here.
That's okay.
But
Nano Server's got tons of thunder all by itself.
You can go out there on the Microsoft TechNet, and you can actually grab this Nano Server WIM generator PowerShell commandlet, right? So now you can use that instead of the new Nano Server image. It would be new WIM, right? So now I can actually, it's a Windows image. So if I'm using Config Manager or I use the example of WinPE, there's a lot of different ways that you can deploy this, right? Just like you would any other Windows image file.
I do a lot of work in education, Clint, and one of the challenges that we have is like some of the branch or outline school security is a concern because they don't have really great cable closets or stuff to lock things up. And having the minimalistic footprint, you know, the least amount of space that you can even attack this thing is really important in those environments, plus being able to rapidly deploy these things. So there's that scenario. The second one is if customers are looking to deploy virtual environments at branch offices. For example, I spoke to somebody in Toronto. They have over 500 branch locations. It would be like a commercial retail location, right? So retail locations scattered all over the place and 800 stores across Canada. I don't really mention customer names just because we're recording, but a large chain. And so they have over 800 Hyper-V hosts that they had deployed. Now they're doing it in 2012 R2 today, but the problem is that they have to go through a whole image engineering process to build that. Whereas if they had Nano, they could deploy Nano to the physical metal, and then they could just layer in their virtual machines. It is extremely easy deployment methodology for them to do that.
Yeah, because of the lack of command prompt on that console, if somebody did happen to stumble through the closet, they don't have to hit, look, I can't run regedit. All the tools you could use to manipulate that environment aren't on the Nano server. You got to do it remotely. You got to have your creds.
Right. So one of the new things that I also wanted to highlight for you guys is this concept that's called PowerShell Direct. Has anybody heard of PowerShell Direct? Yeah, a couple of you folks are shaking your heads. But this allows you to use the actual host VM bus connection, right? I have a host running Hyper-V virtual machines What if one of those guest VMs loses network connectivity? Somebody goes in and makes a configuration change to it, completely bombs it out.
Or the card flat out fails.
Or the, there's a lot of different scenarios.
Or your DHCP fails and you have no IP connectivity. Yep. You can't ping it anymore. That's the scenario. Or you disable the network adapter.
Yeah, this
no physical network connectivity.
Enter PS session dash VM name. Now, VM name is the friendly name of the virtual machine within Hyper-V, right? Hyper-V manager. Just by running that enter PS session dash VM name, I'm now able to interact with this VM, right? So if we zoom in the screen here so you guys can see out a little bit, right? MVP days 007, here's the host name, just like I'm at a command prompt. MVP days 007, I can ping the domain. This laptop, again, is completely off of it, but I'm able to interact with that guest as if I was on it from a command prompt, run PowerShell commands, right? I can come in here and do a get dash service and see all the services that are running on here.
One of the
get dash process.
While you're doing that, one of the coolest examples of this, guys, is somebody messes up a firewall rule. They're using
that
Windows
never
firewall,
happens, Dave.
And you just locked yourself out of the box. You can't RDP to it. You can't do anything. Firewall is blocking everything from the network stack.
Yeah.
PowerShell Direct comes in through the VM bus, circumventing the actual network stack and allows you direct access. So from a post or, you know, if you have scripters that love to do stuff with PowerShell, mm-hmm. now we can automate a lot of those jobs, because before we had to take and we had to set credentials to actually bind in to get into those across the network.
Or you have to mount the VHD directly and have some way to navigate the file system to patch the operating system directly. This is literally, I won't use any filthy words, this is amazing.
Right. So what I've done there is I went into Hyper-V Manager and I completely removed the NIC off this VM.
No, don't do that.
Uh-oh, that's it. We're screwed.
Session's over.
Right? It was pinging. Now all of a sudden it dropped. But I can still come in here, right? And I'm running commands. Host name, right? Get dash process. I'm still on it. I'm able to do things and interact with this VM, even though I have absolutely zero connectivity to it. So just because it's headless doesn't mean it's impossible, right?
Not there's disconnected at all.
Exactly. Yeah. It's still able to interact.
As long as you still manage that machine via Hyper-V in the host environment, yep. you can still get into that. I believe, is it Server 2016 and higher supports that?
Correct, yeah. So the Hyper-V host itself has to be running Server 2016.
How about the guest environments?
The guest environment has to be Server 2016, I believe, as well. I do not think you can backwards interact with I don't quote me on that.
But that's a really
99.9% sure that the environment has to be
one to one. But there's a great business case for Server 2016 by itself there, because the other part would be is if you had spun up all these virtual machines and you had to configure the IP addresses, if they don't have network connectivity, if this was a D&D environment there or any other secure location there, the virtual machines do not need to even have network or internet access to reconfigure those virtual machines.
Any of you guys run Hyper-V today by chance? Couple of you guys?
Do you guys know what a standard operating environment is? So when you're building enterprise servers, you're going to have a standard operating environment build guide for your servers. To build that document with the full version of server in like a GUI version, that document from Microsoft Consulting Services is easily 40 to 50 pages long with all the different things you have to set up and do going along those lines. Do you know how small that document is for Nano Server? There really isn't much we can do with this, right? So at the end of the day, what ends up happening is we're able to take and roll out new products like Server 2016 much, much faster, because there's less work to go in behind engineering and architecting getting this in. If I had to look into the crystal ball, guys, what I would probably say is that Nano Server adoption is going to happen really fast when Server 2016 comes out, because there's not a heck of a lot to actually learn in behind the scenes to manage this. Remember, it's the exact same Hyper-V binaries that you get in Server Core, Server GUI, it's on your Windows 10, it's the same Hyper-V, okay? It's the same failover cluster manager.
Yeah.
All of those pieces are exactly the same for you. It's just got such a light footprint and so easy to deploy. I think this is going to really speed up adoption.
So Dave, I want you to ask me a question. Ask me how I would upgrade from, say, for instance, a 2012 R2 to a Nano Server in a cluster environment.
So Clint, how would you upgrade from 2012 R2 to a 2016 in a nano server environment.
Yeah, so how many, again, a couple of you folks out there are running. I wanted you to set me up to so that I can bring up my last point of the day, right? So if you were interested in upgrading an environment, right? I've got a Hyper-V 2012 cluster, 2012 yes. R2 cluster. How do I get this existing thing that I've got running production workloads, how do I get it upgraded, right? Well, Microsoft has really simplified this for you. So you would simply live migrate all the VMs off of that host to another host in the cluster, evict that host from the cluster, do a bare metal install of Hyper-V, give it the same IP address, give it the same name, whole nine yards, add it back into the cluster. I can now coexist Hyper-V 2012 R2 with 2016 in the same cluster. And then after you upgrade all those hosts, you can then leave it running for a little while to make sure that things are solid, because now the next step in the process is to upgrade the cluster to 2016, right? So it's complete zero downtime upgrade process.
And that's actually a great segue into the next session that we're gonna do here, which I actually have that running in an environment today. So I've got a Hyper-V lab that's in Mountain View with one of the vendors mm-hmm. that I work with. And I wanted to see just how well this works. So I had some lab VMs that were running. My entire cluster was running 2012 R2. I upgraded one of the nodes to 2016, and I was instantly able to live migrate back and forth in that hybrid mode.
Right.
So that's really your upgrade process. It just works. So
kind of the last part of that, though, whenever you do upgrade the cluster, that does force you to upgrade the virtual hardware of those VMs, which causes the VMs to reboot. So you would want to do that during a maintenance window.
And you have to make sure that you don't upgrade those integrated services until you're ready to actually completely move over. That's what allows them to float back and forth. They have to stay at the lower integration services level until you're actually ready to be finished.
Along with the virtual hardware, yeah.
Yeah, so. Exactly. All right, guys.
Yeah, anybody have any questions or anything? Hopefully you found this to be interesting. And for you folks that actually do run Hyper-V in your environment, if you've not ever heard of the Veeam Task Manager for Hyper-V, it's a completely free tool, right? So if you've ever tried to use Task Manager on a Hyper-V host, it's impossible, okay? So this actually goes out and connects to the guest OS partition, and I can see in here how much CPU, how much memory each of my guest virtual machines is using, right? And I can connect to a cluster with that, completely free tool. So if you're running Hyper-V in your environment, you should at least check it out, right?
And that where do you get it from? You just download from Veeam?
Yeah, Veeam.com. Awesome. Veeam.com. And we've got a free section there under the products tab where we have all of our, we have actually quite a few different free solutions available. So that's it, guys. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. Hopefully you enjoyed MVP Days. Thanks for coming out.